All right. Welcome, golfers, to the Blizzard edition of the Scorcher on Par Winter Podcast. Pleased to be joined, as always, by my good friend here and Twitter friend, Kieran Clark of GolfShake.com. How you doing? How you doing, Kieran?
I'm great, Anthony. I must say, I was thinking there just about, you know, old movies that feature a lot of snow and people being snowed in their houses or places. And I was thinking of John Carpenter's The Thing from 1982.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe even the current Tarantino film, The Hateful Eight, or perhaps even the opening hour of The Empire Strikes Back. So hopefully, Anthony, it doesn't get too severe for you.
Yes, it's quite feeling like the Hoth system, if you will, and at the moment. And we've gotten about...
Yeah, and that's a reference for the Star Wars geeks out there.
That's exactly right. That's exactly. And let's pray that within the Hoth system there is no thing. And you've now given me quite concern. You know, a little bit of concern for my dog. For anybody who have seen the thing, nothing good comes from the dog. That's for sure.
No, it does not. That's very true.
So now I'm worried for my pet. So thank you for the.
I apologize,
Anthony. No, I'm just kidding. No, we've gotten about 11 inches to this point. And it is nonstop at this point, and they're predicting, obviously, well over a foot, possibly two. I figured, why not give a little chat a go with yourself and and talk a little bit. You know, it doesn't have to be a long discussion, but I just thought, since I definitely have nothing going on today, and I've already did my bit of shoveling or snow plowing, if you for the time being, before I have to before I have to get bundled up and plow for part two. I just figured we'd get on and have a bit of a chat regarding some things that have coming up, some things that are going on, and some things that have gone on. And one of the things I thought was interesting was the European Tour, which tends to be with the RNA tends to be. You know, I don't know. I wonder if it's like a contest between who can be stiffer, the Blue Jackets of the USGA or the RNA, but. You know, to have the RNA say that, or I should say it's really not the RNA, but the European Tour Championship, really, the European Tour really is the one making the decision. Just the idea of them progressing to allow players to wear shorts, and obviously Rory talking about it and obviously backing it. Your thoughts on this issue or non-issue?
Well, I don't think it's much of an issue one way or the other. And frankly, I've always thought it's quite ridiculous to me that when you see players in the PGA Tour, for example, who could play in the States in August when it's ridiculously hot. When you look at some of the old PGA championships, you know, that are in blazing 110-degree heat, high humidity. And you know, if you or I were playing there, or most regular golfers were playing those golf courses in those conditions, those weather conditions, then we would probably wear shorts. It's the only sensible thing to do. And for me, it seems ridiculous that the tour players can't have that right as well. They can't have that option, that choice. And right. In the end, of course, if Rory decides to wear shorts in a tournament, that doesn't mean that you or I have to wear shorts on our local course on Saturday either. So, again, I think it's the option's important. I think it's the right move to go in the right direction to go into. And I think the European Tour, obviously led by Keith Pelley, the new chief executive there for the past, this is now his first full year in that position, and he's spoken about having a player's first policy to his decision-making. It's all about he consults the players about everything, whether it be sponsors, tournaments, schedules, rules for the Ryder Cup, for example, in terms of the number of events players have got to compete in to be eligible for it. And I think this is another extension of that. Mm-hmm. He's probably went out there, canvassed the players, discussed with them, do you guys want to give us a shot? Would you feel comfortable doing this? And they've probably said yes. So I see no problem with it. And you mentioned the RNA there, Anthony, and that they've also said today that they are considering in the future to perhaps actually allow shorts to be worn in practice rounds for the Open Championship in the coming years. Not this year at Trin, that's already been set in stone, the things for that. But in the future, perhaps could be happening there as well. In the end, you know, the LPGA Tour players, you know, they can wear the shortest skirts you could ever imagine. And in the end, put it this way, if John Daly can wear those trousers, those pants, the golf course, then anybody should be able to wear anything they want, just about.
Yeah, no, I know. Nothing could be, even the whitest of legs or OB steaks, if you will, cannot offend anything any more than what John Daly wears.
Well, I must say, I wouldn't be too keen on seeing Tim Herron in a pair of shorts, I must admit.
No, especially when it gets humid and whatnot. But
oh dear, no.
You know, you mentioned a name, Keith. Is it Pelley? Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Yeah, Keith Pelly, yeah.
Keith Pelly. You know, since you brought him up, any initial reaction to his reign to this point?
Well, I think he talks a very good game. I think he has the right sort of ambition. He's spoken about trying to turn the European Tour into what he calls a viable alternative to the PGA Tour for the next 5 years. So that obviously means a huge increase in prize money. That's obviously a massive goal to try and achieve, given the disparity between most events in the European Tour and the PGA Tour. But I think he's got to, in the end, bolster the purses. I think what he did with the Italian Open, for example, where obviously the Ryder Cup's going there in 2022, and as part of the deal for that, he negotiated a contract where the Italian Open will have its prize fund increased by, I think, 7 times over the next few years. So it'll become a €7 million tournament from next year onwards, having been only a €1.5 million tournament this year.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing things like that where he's out there trying to increase prize money to attract the big players to stay on this side of the pond rather than play on the PGA Tour. And again, it's a massive task for him, but I think he has the right ambition, he has the right direction for it. In the end, if you want to do something, you have to, at very least, actually admit there's a problem. You have to set that kind of objective out there, and I think he has done. But another thing he has to do as well is try and increase work with the other tours in the world, the PGA of Australasia, the Sunshine Tour, Asian Tour, work closer with them, almost create an all-world tour out with America.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably the only way they can, in the future, have some sort of viable alternative to the PGA Tour. So obviously, early days for Keith Pelly, but I like the cut of his jib. I like the way he talks. I like what he has to say. I think he's positive. I think he's quite dynamic. He has a lot of experience in the media and sports media in Canada. So he knows what he's talking about. I think he has the vision to do something. Whether he quite has the, he can do it in the end is another thing entirely. But for so far, I'm impressed.
Yeah, I would. I agree. Definitely talks a good game. And if nothing else, he's certainly the most fashion forward head of the European Tour. That's for sure.
He actually has an Elton John lookalike in his free time, with those glasses.
Yeah, he's got quite the doppelganger there. I agree with you on all points. He seems young and ambitious and sort of maybe the right guy at the right time for a new generation of golfers.
Yeah.
In
the end, obviously, you look back in the past 10 years after Ken Schofield stood down, The European Tour had reached a position where it had a large number of events around the world. Then, of course, the financial crash happened and they lost so many events in continental Europe, obviously the great heartland of the Tour. So it's a very tough environment. In the end, I think, George O'Grady and the Tour at that time, they created the race to Dubai. They bolstered themselves in the Middle East and so on. But in the end, I think they need better quality events and better quality golf courses all across the world. And that's how you're going to draw people. I think actually having people like Rory almost taking charge of their own events, becoming the kind of the host of it, the Irish Open, for example, Ian Poulter last year at the British Masters at Woburn. I think that's the way to go. Get the players more involved in the decision-making process and in running events. And I think that'll be attractive to them and also to sponsors going forward.
It seems like the European is borrowing the PGA's idea of the Ryder Cup Task Force, getting people involved, players involved. No, I'm just kidding. That's not at all. But I'm just kidding. I agree. It's definitely a way to go, and it seems like you've got some pretty powerful and young players on the tour, European mm-hmm. tour. Obviously, Rory's going to have the biggest voice, it seems, at this point. I mean, there's some elder statesmen that have quite a bit of stature on the European tour as well. But I just feel like it seems like the right guy for the right time. And if anything, he's got a good fashion sense about him. And just to bring it back to the shorts, I agree with you that I don't see it's really not really an issue. I don't understand why the PGA Tour balks at the idea. I'm assuming they are this sort of going with the stiff idea of or an inflexible idea of that this is their uniform and this is their business attire and sort of when they're doing the pro-am, they're working. I can't imagine a pro-am player who is paid X amount of money to play with, and it's quite a generous amount of money to play with a PGA Tour player. I can't imagine anybody saying he better be wearing pants. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Most players at home, most of these rich guys go out and play in the sun and everywhere, they'll be wearing shorts as well. And it's common sense. You're playing in really hot weather, you want to wear the shorts. If perhaps you're coming over to the Open Championship and you're playing at Royal Troon and it's 30 mile per hour winds and pouring down with rain, then maybe you want to wear the pants and the trousers. But in the end, I think one way or the other, it's not a major issue. For me, it's what is a more important issue, however, is actually at regular golf clubs, the dress code that they still enforce, particularly in this country. I'm not quite sure what it's like over in the US, but over here, not even the high-end clubs here, middle-ranked clubs still have really quite strict dress codes. And I think that's poor, because in the end, you want to encourage people to come and play golf, and any sort of barriers you can put up, even small ones like that, you know, it's too many. And have to have the game more inclusive and open for everybody, and in the end, reflect the modern lifestyle. Because in the end, most people now don't dress, they don't wear +4s and whatever else, and knickers like the guys wore back in the 20s. You know, things have moved on, progressed over time. And you know, if it was good enough for those guys back in the 20s to wear sort of three-quarter length trousers then, I think we can do it today. So I think one way or the other, it's not a major issue, but and in the end, it's only the common sense decision to actually allow shorts to be worn, at very least in practice rounds. I think in the future that will eventually lead to actually players in tournaments probably being able to wear them as well.
Yeah, and you know, let's not forget the entertainment factor. I mean, one of the fun things about the road to the U.S. The U.S. Open is the fact that we get to see these guys. They're always, obviously, they call it here in the States, they call it the longest day in golf, and it's the Open qualifying all over the country, and you know, Golf Channel's always there. And one of the things that we get to see is those guys. I think it's fun for the fans. They get to see guys as they don't normally see them, and they're wearing shorts, and it's always you know, fun to see guys in different environments. And so, you know, like you said, I think it's, you know, it's a no-brainer. It's practice rounds. If you want to hold off on the majors, fine. But, you know, the PGA Tour, whatever it is, Timmy Fincham and his Iron Fist, you know, continues to do things his own way. And that's it, you know.
Can I quickly say there, Anthony? I think it's interesting you actually mentioned Tim Fincham there. And, you know, he kind of the dictatorial, authoritarian asset of his leadership, compared, contrasted with Keith Pelly. I think that's probably quite appealing. I'm sure a lot of players in the PGA Tour, obviously they appreciate the big money they play for, and that's partly down to Tim Fincham. But in the end, you know, Fincham has a salary of, I think it's something like $13 million.
Sure.
You know, last year, he was the second most most lucrative person on the tour behind Jordan Spieth. And I think players look at that and think, you know, I feel uneasy about that at times. I think a lot of players, the European guys, would look at Keith Pelly, look at the European Tour, and say, you know what, I would rather play more there than in the PGA Tour if the money was better. And in the end, these guys are professionals. It's all about the big money. And I think Keith Pelly has the right approach where, you know, include the players, talk with them, and I think you have a better strategy going forward for everybody. But I think in the end, the PGA Tour runs from top to bottom. I think Keith Pelly is trying to do more of a bottom-up approach to running the tour, and I think it's probably the right way to go.
Well, I agree, but let's also, you know, not to defend Fincham at all in his ways, but, you know, they're also operating from two different perspectives. I mean, you have the business side of PGA Tour and someone like Fincham making, like you said, upwards of $13 million with bonuses or whatever the case may be. He can afford to he can afford to run an operation that's top down, whereas Pelly's like, you know, I take him to a much like Mike Wan, who took over for the LPGA Tour and had to fix everything that Gibbons had screwed up.
Yeah.
He had to take a bottom up, and well, I guess on some levels a bottom up, but certainly a corporate friendly view and whatnot. So they're not exactly apples to apples, but I take your point. You know, Timmy could be a little less Frank Sinatra and I'll do it my way kind of guy and maybe be a little more, you know, be a little more receptive and a little more progressive.
Well, of course,
you know.
Tim's coming up for his retirement, but the question is, will he actually retire?
Will he
try and knock aside this upstart Keith Pelly?
Yeah, no, you know, I feel like, you know, sometimes it gets to the point where you're like, he looks around and he says, well, who am I leaving this to? And who's going to do a better job than I'm doing? That kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good point.
All right, let's move on to, we probably spent longer, it was supposed to be a short discussion on shorts, but it got us rolling into a couple of different directions. Rory, I mentioned in my own words, said that that Spieth had put him on notice by winning the Hyundai Tournament of Champions, and mm-hmm. sort of, I don't look at this as Rory is responding. Rory's just Rory. When he plays well, he's going to play really well, and just a matter of how often and when it occurs or where it occurs, it will be the big story. But certainly a good story this week with the Abu Dhabi Championship, or HSBC Championship, if you will. If nothing else, it gives us something other than the career builders, but quite a nice leaderboard there.
Yeah, Rory, I think on Thursday when they're playing together at Ricky Fowler, and Rory was so good in the first round. His driving was just imperious, and he looked really back to his best. And even Spieth said himself afterwards, where it was a case of Jordan said that, that was the Rory that has won majors, and to compete with that, I've got to get better. And Spieth was within two shots of him, only because he putted really well. Spieth was actually a little bit out of form on the first day. I actually think in a funny old way that Spieth was almost pushing himself to try and match Rory. He's standing there watching Rory bomb the ball 340 down the middle of the fairway all the time. I think he almost got out of his own rhythm to try and find extra length, and that's a dangerous path to try and go down. He's actually spoken about it as well, maybe trying to lengthen his game slightly. I think that's an iffy path to go down. But when you stand to Rory and how well he hits the ball, it is probably quite understandable why you feel that way. But Rory, as you say, he's so good when he's on, and he was certainly on his Thursday. He wasn't so great in the second round. He was a bit rusty there. Again, he hasn't really played for 8 weeks. He hasn't really touched the club for 2 months before last week, so he's come in relatively cold. And he came back today stronger, and obviously he's in a very good position going into the second half of the third round, and then the fourth round tomorrow. Obviously we're catching up because we had a delay in the second day. So mm-hmm. Rory looks good, and I keep saying it. The question is obviously who. If everyone plays to their best, who wins? The answer for me has always been Rory. But then again, in recent times, Spieth sort of maybe had me questioning that because of how well he played, particularly at Hyundai, obviously winning at 30 under. Would Rory have got lower than that? I'm not sure he would have done. So, but in the end, it's a contrasting styles, and they're both still in the mix. Now, even though Spieth hasn't been quite at his best, he's kind of an iffy week, obviously, with the rules officials at times, and he's had a bit of but not smoothest week of all time, but he's still right there. With obviously, it's still 27 holes to go in the tournament. So they're both still right in the mix, and what should be a really exciting final day because there's 27, 30 guys all within three shots, and it's going to be a real shootout tomorrow. Don't forget Ricky Fowler is right up there as well.
Yep. And it's just interesting. You brought up the point of him, Spieth's words. I think the interesting thing about his comments about trying to lengthen his game or a little bit and sort of comparing himself to Rory and like you said, sort of being watching that all day long can be a little bit of intimidating, especially when it's on, obviously. But definitely. I find it interesting about Spieth is that one of the things that we applaud him is for his maturity and his poise, and yet here he is revealing almost on some level being not comfortable with who he is. And I know he's talking about trying to improve his game, but you would think the guy, what he's accomplished to this point, would be comfortable with what he's doing. I'm not saying, don't try and get better, but when you to allow yourself to be sort of influenced by the bombing drives of Rory, which is almost on some levels unfair. You that's like me trying to be Dustin Johnson. It's just not going to happen. he is who he is and you are, Yeah. I just found it interesting that he would even be, like you said, along those thoughts. So just interesting.
I think Spieth, in the end, is a real natural competitor in every sense. Yeah. Whether it be in the tournament, I think he's someone who goes into practice putting green. He wants to hold more putts than the other guy. When he's on the range, he wants to hit better shots than the guy next to him in the other booth. I think as a competitor, he looks at Rory and says, I want to be able to do that or get closer to him. Mm-hmm. And again, as you say, it is a trap potentially. Players have in the past obviously tried to, quote-unquote, make themselves better, even though they're world number one. Luke Donald tried to do it. Parag Harrington tried to do it. He won two majors and he tried to change his swing. He's never really got back from that.
Yep.
I don't think Spieth's going to make that mistake. But I think, as you say, he's got to look at the situation where he's got to where he has with the tools that he already possesses. But I think he's mindful as well that when you see Rory the way he plays, he's probably thinking, if Rory goes out there and plays like that, can I realistically beat him over 72 holes? And there's probably some doubt there. Whether it's justified or not, I think Spieth's got many skills that Rory doesn't quite have. I think Spieth's got he's a better putter. I think he's got a better, at times, golfing brain. He's perhaps slightly more consistent as well. But at the same time, looking at those tools that Rory has, we all watch Rory and think, I'd love to be able to drive the ball at Rory. And I think the players on the tour feel that way even more than we do. even the world number one. And that's partly testament to how good Rory's driving actually is, and that's a positive for him. But I think Spieth, as I say, is a natural competitor. He wants to bridge the gap in every way possible. He feels that, you know, to be the best player and to stay there, he's got to go along with these guys and get better as he goes along, as he gets older. And he's only 22, obviously, and I think he looks in the future and is thinking, well, you know, I had a great 2 years, year and a half, playing at the absolute optimum of my game. And for him to stay there, probably, if Rory coming back to fitness and hopefully consistent form, and another guy's there as well, and Jason Day, of course, he's got to think, well, and Dave got a very similar game to Rory, and I think some people are thinking that, you know, I've got to try and get closer to them to be consistently still beating them in most tournaments.
Yeah, and, you know, you took the two names right out of my mouth. I was about to say those two names with Luke Donald and Padraig Harrington. But
yeah.
I just think it's a dangerous game. You know, it's one thing to polish a statue, and then it's another thing to take out the hammer and chisel and make adjustments. So
I agree with that, yeah.
You know, it's just a dangerous game, and, you know, was a little shocked by those. I agree with you. He is a competitor, but I think you also have to keep things in perspective.
I think it showed almost a vulnerability to him.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking.
That was surprising. You know, I was pleased to hear how refreshingly honest he is.
Yep.
But it's the sort of thing that maybe Tiger would never have given away, obviously. So it was an odd one.
Yeah, it was. It was. And I'm glad you brought it up. Let's turn our attention to one of his playing partners was Bryson DeChambeau, and he was his sort of an interesting character, an interesting look about him. Caught a little flack today because he didn't help Andy Sullivan look for his ball. Just your impressions of the kid.
Well, he's a fascinating character. You know, we all know that the story of him playing with the irons are all the same length. And he's got that sort of physics attitude. Obviously, he's a physics major, I think, at college, and he brings that sort of knowledge and that intelligence and analytical nature to the game of golf, and it makes perfect sense. Obviously, it's worked for him winning the US Amateur and coming out this week and playing really well. And obviously, he wears kind of the Ben Hogan cap, and he has that sort of traditional look. So he's a fascinating character, and clearly a very good player. But today, I think he did let himself down. He has apologized on Twitter, and that's fair enough. And I think he was probably authentic about it. But to me, it was an odd thing. He said he thought it. Sullivan hit the ball in the water rather than, you know, to me, how unaware can you really be on a golf course? I know players are focused and whatever else. To me, it showed a lack of awareness, which you really have to have as a player in a tournament. You have to really respect the players you're playing with and know what they're doing in their situation so you can help them and help the field and really kind of stick with the integrity of the game. So I think in the end, it's one strike. We'll give them more chances, but it's something to look out for in the future. Maybe it's an inexperienced thing, I'm not sure. And talking about him going forward, you know, I've heard that the chat is that he's going to play in the Masters coming up in April, obviously there as US Amateur Champion, and then he'll turn professional just after Augusta. He's going to forego the exemptions into the US Open and in the Open Championship. He's going to turn pro immediately after Augusta. So certainly he's a fascinating player, brings a different sort of approach to the game, and that's good. You know, me and you have both said in the past that we both think the game's at times quite one-dimensional, and he's something a bit different. So I think we as golf fans should probably embrace that.
Yeah, I agree. I think we want a little something, a little, you know, there's something a little quirky about him. Maybe it's the, you know, the fizz, like you said, the he's got a little bit of that mad scientist kind of intellectual bit about him. And, you know, that shouldn't be an excuse for bad manners, but he's definitely a guy in his own world and, you know, thinks about the world a little differently than we all do. You know, just in his, you know, Andy Sullivan could have helped everybody out by hitting a provisional, by the way. That would have been,
that's true.
You know, that might have been helpful as well. But, yeah, no excuse for him to not help at least. And let's, you know, like I said, I don't think we should get all about the guy, you know, all over the kid. I mean, he's a kid.
No,
and,
not at all.
And I think, you know, people on Twitter and social media tend to get a little, you know, judgmental fairly quickly. and we forget, you know, a lot of people where, you know, Phil Mickelson wasn't the coolest guy out there when he came, and some people don't think he's cool at all now, but he wasn't as, let's say, accepted and in terms of his, you know, how he acted towards the media, and or he was a little bit flippant sometimes, and he was a little bit, you know, I'm smarter than you, kind of. And, you know, he matured like everybody else matures, and some people do it faster than others. Let's hope he does it a little faster. And but he's a young kid, and, you know, let's give him a little bit of a break and give him a chance. But I agree, back to your point, it's good, you know, I there's nothing wrong with having people with different personalities. You know, for all we make fun of Patrick Reed, at least we have someone to poke fun at and to have, you know, to say, you know, to bring up a different conversation. It would be quite dull a conversation if they were all the same, that's for sure.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I was actually going to bring up Patrick Reed there when you're saying that, because he is obviously, you know, he's brash, he's supremely, well, bordering on arrogant at times.
Sure.
And he's got that sort of almost like a pantomime villain's aspect to him. But, you know, I like Patrick Reed. I think he's something different. I'm not saying I'd like to sit down and have dinner with him, but, you know, but I like watching him play. I like watching how he goes about his business. I think it's something a bit different. He's got that sort of brash nature, overconfident perhaps. But at the same time, he's a really good player. And I think we need that in the game. We need characters, not robots.
Yeah, and let's just set the record straight here. If you're a professional golfer and you're not borderline arrogant and confident in what you do, then you're not going to last. You know, it's going to be like the NFL, not for long. So let's, you know, when we say that, now obviously there's a difference between, let's say, Patrick Reed arrogance and Jordan Spieth arrogance and confidence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I understand what you're saying, but they're all arrogant. Let's just, you know,
That's right. You know, even go back to, everyone talks about Jack Nicklaus, obviously, had his birthday the other day, and Jack Nicklaus is obviously, you know, the greatest player of all time, really, and all. But at the same time, you know, he was an arrogant man as well. We all know that. Yeah, but he had a certain way about it. He was respectful with it, but he was arrogant. You know, but you have to have that cockiness, that self belief to reach the top. You know, there are many great talented players who don't make it. And in the end, what separates Jordan Spieth from another great amateur player at college is probably the attitude. It's probably what separates them from being a success and not making it at all. So you have to have the attitude as well as the skill set to be a success in any sport, particularly golf.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to be, you know, in the top 0.01% of your profession, and you know how razor thin that line is between, and it maybe just come down to a number of, you know, putts between the PGA Tour and the Web.com Tour and another challenge tour. You better have your, you better be confident in what you're doing. All right, let's finish up with. You know, I didn't want to talk about the career builders, but the fact that my man Phil was had showed a little life, and it's just it's nice to see him out there playing again. And but, you know, I'm also pleased for Jamie Lovemark. He's tied for second place. You know, he's a kid who I liked coming out of college. I liked him on the Web.com Tour, and then was sidelined with some, I think, bad back injury or some, you know, some ailments, and so you know, I'm pleased for him. And I like Bill Haas too. He's a nice kid. So it's not a bad leaderboard. It's nice. You know, it's a terrible tournament to watch, but you know, there's some quality people at least up on the leaderboard.
Yeah, that's right. There is, and obviously Jason Duffner, who of course has had a really kind of rough year, both on and off the course, injury wise, health wise, and obviously personal life wise. He kind of disappeared really last year. But he's come back and he's played well last week. He played well this week. Obviously, he's leading right now, I believe. So he's, you know, he's maybe getting back to the level he was 3 or 4 years ago. And he's obviously a quality player. Had a suspect issue with his putting. It's always been there. But, you know, ball striking wise, he's way up there. He's very consistent. You know, Bill Haas, obviously defending champion there. You know, a good player. But Phil Mickelson, you know, you say showing life, and people kind of have forgotten about Phil this year. You know, and it's funny because obviously he hasn't been consistent really since he won the Open at Muirfield at all. That's his last win on the PGA Tour, I believe. So he hasn't really done much in terms of winning. But at the same time, we forget that he was second at Augusta last year.
Yep.
And Valhalla and the PGA just a few months before that. So, you know, Phil's still got that big game mentality where, you know, he gets in the right position, the right frame of mind. You know, he talks about energy a lot, you know, mental energy, physical energy. When Phil's up for it, something, he gets into the groove, gets confident. You know, he can still play and he can still compete. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Phil still can be one of those guys that can maybe be like a Fred Couple, sort of contend at Augusta into his late 40s, into his 50s. And he's obviously working now with a guy, I think his name is Andrew Getson, I think it is, from Scottsdale.
Right.
Obviously, he left Butch Harmon at the end of last year. So, you know, Phil, he's coming up for 46, but at the same time, you know, he's, if he keeps healthy and keeps fit, And if he keeps positive and he gets in the right position, gets in the right frame of mind, he can still play. We're not, well, you don't know how good he is. He don't become a bad player overnight. And Phil Mickelson is still one of the best players of his generation. And the guy, it's only 3 years since he last won a major. So Phil can still play. And obviously, starting the season really well here, and maybe he can build it towards Augusta now and maybe have another good chance of winning there again.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I think Phil has always sort of gotten off to fast starts. In his career, I think most of his wins, quite frankly, I think are from the West Coast Tour. When you break it down, so you know he's always sort of like, you know, he likens to me like a kid who's like waiting for Christmas and sort of like, you know, he gets all fired up and he comes out like gangbusters on the West Coast Tour, and then he kind of peters out, and then hopefully he's there in the majors, and then the season kind of takes on a life of its own. But he's always ready for the, it seems like, for the West Coast Tour, although obviously recent years, you know, showing a general decline. And like you said, he's got health issues that he's got to contend with, and who knows what goes on in the personal lives of these guys. And plus, you know, just the general aging process will do numbers on you. It's like everybody says, for all the time is undefeated. So, and you know, you throw that in there with a mix of young and talented new players, it's going to be harder and harder.
But I think still at the same time, Anthony, you know, we look at this year in particular, I think with the Ryder Cup coming up in September, and we remember, of course, you mentioned the task force earlier, and Phil was the guy that kicked that all off with that unbelievable press conference at Glen Eagles, of course, when he threw Tom Watson under the bus, then reversed over him once again. You know, incredible scenes.
Yeah.
And Phil started that all off. And I think for him, he wants to feel that this is probably his last chance, realistically, to get on a Ryder Cup team again. Obviously, he played in the President's Cup last year, and he enjoyed that. I think he enjoyed the young guys, he enjoyed that environment, and he cares about it, as he saw at Glen Eagles. And he's a competitor, he's a major champion, and he's probably a bit more annoyed by the fact he's got a terrible record in the Ryder Cup teams over the years. And he's been there for 20-odd years now, and he's won maybe twice in that time. So I think he's frustrated by that. Obviously, he's the one that really started the whole process of the task force and Davis Love and all the different vice captains that process has put him. And I think he's now desperately got on the team this September. So I think Phil's perhaps more determined than he has been in a few years. But as you say, he starts the season really well usually. Then he kind of peters out into the summer. So, you know, Phil, I still think he's not going to be the player that he was, but in the odd week, he can still win. I'm certain of that.
Yeah, and I believe it. I think everybody says that they want to win, and I know that they do. But I really, you know, Phil is sort of gets a bit of stick, I guess, if you will, because he kind of says things positive all the time, and maybe even when it doesn't look like it or whatever the case may. But I mean, he does, despite his age and health issues, whatever. He still is passionate about the game, and I think you're right.
Definitely.
I mean, the bottom line is part of the reason that he threw Tom Watson under the bus was for exactly what he said in the press conference. Now, obviously, there was something personal going on because he wanted to play in that, and Tom sat him or whatever the case may be. But he was pissed, and he wanted to, you know, he's tired of losing. He doesn't want to go out in the sunset of his career with another losing Ryder Cup, and he wants to, like you said, you know, not only just play one more, but maybe win one more before he can walk away with the game. So I think that was partly, a lot of frustration of what has gone on. And you can argue about whether how he did it and whether the, you know, and we can have this debate about the ends justifies the means. But we know that the PGA of America moves slow. We know that the RNA moves very slow, and he needed to jumpstart something, and that was just the way it went down, and so maybe it was a perfect storm to get it kickstarted, and who knows if he doesn't say anything and he does the right thing, and you know, doesn't say anything on air and does the right thing and does it all behind closed doors, who's to say that nothing would have changed? Because he forced their hand to do something he felt, and of course it came off spoiled and all that kind of stuff. I get it, but I also get that he's 46 and he wants to win one more, and he's a competitor, and you know, it's not something I would have done, or it's not how I would have done it, but you know, we're dealing with competitors and people who want to win, and that's the important, and to them, that's really, at the end of the day, that's what they want to do. They want to compete,
definitely.
And they want to win.
I think, Phil, as you say there, you know, Valhalla in 2008, he loved that experience so much, not just of being on a winning team, but obviously he became almost a senior part of the team. He was with Anthony Kim, of course, had that energy, loved that partnership. He loved that. He loves being sort of an important figure in that system. He loves being almost the leader of the team on the course. And I think Tom Watson perhaps felt threatened by that behind the scenes, by Phil's big personality and the relationship he has with particularly younger players. I think Watson tried to almost undermine that by being sort of an authoritarian leader in the team room. That obviously didn't work in the end. So I think Phil wants to get back on a team so he can almost assume that leadership role on the course. And I think they'll have an understanding, you know, Davis Love and Tiger and all these guys are involved, Steve Stricker and Jim Furyk. I think they all have scar tissue from the Ryder Cup. They all know that what has gone down in the past hasn't worked. I think they all have come together now. And in the end, if US wins this year, maybe wins two in a row or something, they'll look back at Glenn Eagles and think, you know what, that was perhaps the important date, the date that changed the course of that competition, where the US actually finally brushed themselves down, the US team and the players and the leadership, and actually said, well, you know what, what we're doing isn't working right now. And the Europeans have been successful for 20 years doing this a certain way. Why don't we do that as well? I think if they follow that approach, they've certainly got the players to win the competition. And, again, the proof will be in September. So it's one of the great kind of plot lines going into this year, whether the Americans' new approach will actually prove fruitful at Hazeltine later this year.
Well, I think, you know, I do. And it is one of the interesting plot lines. But I think there's a little bit of a fly in the ointment for Phil, because I don't think he expected Tiger to be on hand as an assistant captain. And I feel like that sort of, it won't be like he's the alpha male. He won't be the only alpha male there, that's for sure. Maybe he'll be the only alpha male playing in terms of team leadership. But the fact that Tiger's there lurking around in the shadows there as an assistant captain, I feel like that almost takes away a little bit from him. I feel like players on some level will have one eye looking at Phil and one eye looking at Tiger. And, I wonder if it's just one of those things that we'll never know, because we're so insulated from it. And maybe years from now, we'll find out what it's like behind the scenes. But I just feel like without Tiger being around for a while, I feel like Phil has been running wild with the team and just been going crazy. and now with Tiger lurking around, I almost feel like, no one will admit it, certainly not Phil and certainly not Tiger, but it definitely brings an interesting dynamic. And I'm not sure it's a positive one per se, but again, I am forging this all this speculation based on an outside viewer's view, perspective of the scene. But I feel like given his, if he had a magic wand, I think he would remove Tiger from the assistant captain's role and give him one more year of running, roaming free without another Tiger on the on the horizon there, overlooking him.
Well, I think it's possible to have one too many big personalities in one room.
Right.
I think that could be the case this September. You have Tiger and Phil there. And Davis Love as a captain is almost going to feel like they're kind of on the side.
Yeah.
I think he'll be more receptive to that than Tom Watson was, like last time. I think Love is a different character than Watson, not quite as old school in his approach. So, but at the same time, you're right. I think the two big alpha males there in that team room, that'll be interesting. And I think Phil perhaps wants to be the alpha male on the course, that important distinction. He's actually on the course and Tiger's on the side.
Right.
To actually be a leader on the course of a young player or whatever else in actual playing himself. So, as you say, I think two big personalities, that can be a negative if they both kind of rub each other up the wrong way.
Yep, absolutely. So well, Kieran, I am done procrastinating. I have to go and shovel now. So we're going to have to
get back outside and shovel some more snow. Come on.
you thought I was doing a nice thing here, but I had an agenda here, man. I just didn't want to go out there again. I got to go got to get on my Tauntaun and head out to the, I heard there was a, some sort of.
There's another old Star Wars reference right there. Yeah.
Well, but thanks again for joining me and we'll talk
to
you
soon.
It's been
a pleasure, Anthony.
Absolutely. We'll talk soon.
Stay safe now.
And we'll speak again next week. You got it.
Look forward to it. Cheers.
Cheers.